We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shootings, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
A drug policy problem. Opioid addiction. An epidemic. How did we get here? What's wrong with these kids these days? What can be done to effectively cut down on the opioid crisis? Since the problem has moved beyond the largely black inner cities and now plagues the suburbs and beyond, having seen local kids taken down by these deadly drugs, people are coming together to figure out what works to stop this deadly epidemic. On October 19th at Portsmouth's Strawberry Bank, experts, including recovering addicts, will gather to share what they have learned and offer some current solutions. Among those presenting are our guest today, Vic Maloney, Executive Director of Seacoast Youth Services, and Sarah Fetris, Director of Intensive Outpatient Program Services there. Sarah, and I think, Vic, are you there?
I'm here. Vic actually wasn't able to get on the line, but I'm here.
Oh, okay. Well, we have a lot to discuss here. It certainly is a nationwide program, and frankly, problem, rather. It baffles me. I just, it's hard for me to understand. And let me thank you first for the work you do. Extremely important. Let me ask, are these white, middle-income young people so depressed and hopeless that they insist on numbing their pain, even knowing the high risk of death from these substances? Or do they not know the high risk of death from these substances?
I mean, it's a great question. I think it's a little bit of both. I don't think it's that they don't know about the risk, but I think adolescents' brains aren't really designed or developed enough to really understand or comprehend how it can happen to them. So it's sort of when they're weighing their risk and reward, they're looking, you know, more at the immediate gratification and not at the long-term risk.
So how is education working? I mean, I know we've tried all different ways of getting into the heads of these kids. And, you know, I know people whose kids have died from this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
How is education working and how is it being done? I assume there's programs in schools. Are they missing the boat? Are they effective enough? Are there other programs that kids are aware of? Do they know what resources might be available?
I think it's a combination. I do think that a big piece of the education now is just changing our thinking and changing kind of our language and the discussion around the epidemic and around mental health in general, and kind of working on erasing the stigma. And you know, something I heard kind of in the beginning when you're introducing the show, where you say, "What's wrong with these kids?"
Right,
and,
right.
And you know, really, it's kind of looking at what happened to these kids. What's happening to these kids, and how can we look at that and sort of the challenges that they're facing now that maybe we didn't face, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and how can we change our thinking and our approach to keep up with that and helping erase that stigma, because, you know, these kids are dealing with a lot, and they're dealing with depression and anxiety, and they're medicating it in ways that we didn't used to have at our fingertips. So it's kind of, I think it's all of the above. It's kind of changing our thinking and changing the approach and looking at, you know, what are they going through? What happened to them, you know?
Yeah, it's always having a 16-year-old and a 21-year-old. adolescence is not a period I would want to go through again.
No.
But it seems to me that, as you're saying, one of the associated problems is the judgment addicts may feel, or even users may feel, like they are entirely to blame. There's something wrong with them. They are weak people. How much of a problem is that getting them in the way of effective treatment? And how is that best dealt with? That, you know, to these kids believing it's all their problem, that they're weak, that there's something wrong with them. It seems to me that is a big problem because people do make those judgments.
It's absolutely a huge problem. And it's, I mean, that's, I think, a big piece of what, as a community, we have to work together to, you know, stand up against that stigma. But absolutely, I mean, if you take, you know, take a 16, 17, 18-year-old who realizes they have any disease, I mean, realize that they find out that they have cancer. You know, they're dealing with, they have access to treatment, they have access to support. But if you take a kid who, you know, has an addiction, also a disease, the support really isn't as available. And it's, and not only that, but there's a lot of judgment. And
right.
So, you know, as a community and as, you know, as people that are trying to support one another and educate and, you know, we really need to be looking at how available are these services and who has access to them. So it's a huge part of the problem.
If you just tuned in, Keeping Democracy Live, Bert Cohen here, your host, and we're talking with Sarah Fitris, Director of Intensive Outpatient Program Services with Seacoast Youth Services. We're talking about the opioid crisis. And I wonder what kids are feeling out there. You know, it seems to me, remembering, you know, 100 years or so ago, that young people, just kidding, always push the envelope. You know, back when I was in high school, there was smoking in the boys' room and drinking to excess. It's always been there. I have to tell you, I was shocked recently. I'm really shocked. I was walking my dog through some woods to see some graffiti on a big chunk of concrete that said in large letters, "I'm on heroin again." That just shocked the heck out of me. Is there some status with heroin use among kids? I mean, what are you finding?
Yeah, you know, I think you kind of touched on something really important, and it's that, you know, back in the day, quote unquote, we, you know, kids, it was just kind of an okay thing that kids will be kids and kids will drink and
right.
kids might smoke marijuana and, you know, oh, they're just being teenagers. But
right.
that's really not the case anymore because smoking weed at a party, at that same party are going to be kids that have brought pills from their parents', you know, recent shoulder surgery or,
Ooh.
You know, someone got, you know, their wisdom teeth out and were prescribed a painkiller. And those pills are popping up and then it really quickly can escalate to, you know, opioids, benzos. I mean, it goes so fast and so gone really are the days of feeling secure, sweeping things under the rug. Oh, he's just drinking. He's a teenager. He still gets good grades. He still's on the football team. You know, he's just being a kid. Well, we don't have time to play around with that sort of thing because, you know, before you know it, that's not all they're doing anymore. So I think that, you know, in keeping up with what we're facing now as a society and in this, you know, in our very community are the fact that, you know, these kids are using cough syrup, you know, and overdosing on cough syrup. Huh. So, you know, we've got to keep up with that. And one of the things that we kind of address in our program and trying to keep that sort of, you know, and keep the parents involved and, you know, engaged in the process is helping them to understand that things that are in your very home are very dangerous and your kids have access to them and those are the things kids are using. And it's a different era.
Well, you, Sarah, you deal directly. I mean, you're with intensive outpatient program services. Well, the kids probably, I'm guessing, wouldn't say, oh, yeah, it looks so cool to be taking these pills or even heroin. They probably wouldn't ever admit that. How do you deal with that? What do you do to address that?
You know, it starts with the insight. You know, a lot of the times, you know, quite frankly, in my program, we have kids that maybe aren't there because they want to be there.
Uh-huh, right.
But if there is any sort of the slightest fraction of motivation or the slightest sense of, maybe I do use more than my friends do, you know, we can take that and kind of say, okay, so, you know, what are the feelings behind it? And, you know, maybe they're not admitting that they started doing something because it looked cool, but they may be able to say, yeah, I mean, now I thought I could stop, but I really can't. And, you know, I might, you know, we have kids that might say, you know, oh, you can't be addicted to marijuana. Well, okay, then, but you tried to stop and you couldn't. So, and, you know, we can work with that. And it's really taking what's in front of us and, you know, having the kids get an opportunity to really look inward and with support and with kids around them that are also struggling, you know, and they may not be at that point where they're all ready to say, okay, yes, we're, you know, we're 100% on board, but they're learning something, and it's going to be really important for them to learn those little pieces along the way.
And I mean, peer pressure, you know, that's huge for kids. I think they probably get more, they're probably more open to listening to their peers than to us parents, so-called adults. What do we know after all? Tell us about your program, actually, and how it might fit in at the national level. You know, I can't help but think that we're learning so much that it must be replicable.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that the big piece about dealing with adolescents, and certainly something we run into a lot in my program, is the level of readiness. And we can't assume that all of these adolescents are in a place where they are saying, yes, I want help.
Yeah.
That's actually quite rare.
Yeah,
so,
I'm sure.
You know, we really take a kind of holistic approach of having a lot of clinicians on staff with a lot of different backgrounds, working with the parents and whatever external motivation these kids have to stay in the program, that's what we use. Some of them are on probation, and they, you know, they're working hard to just comply with the rules of probation, and that means showing up to our program. Some of them, you know, it could be something as small as a parent saying, look, you're not going to get your driver's license until you've dealt with this issue and maybe you can have a clean drug screen with no marijuana popping up. So we're taking all these factors and then planting seeds. And so we use a lot of different styles in our program and really kind of evidence-based models because that's, you know, for adolescents, it's kind of the go-to. And we're looking at, we use a style of therapy called DBT. It's a lot of coping skills. It's a lot of helping kids identify their triggers and building support systems and having skills to be able to feel confident and feel that they can be in a situation and maybe say no and make positive choices for their lives and their futures. So it's a lot of things. And we also use an adventure-based model. One day a week, we get out into the community and do something active, or it may be not, you know, necessarily athletic, but it could, you know, art or hiking or rock climbing or whatever it is to really help these kids build experiences and sort of modeling that there are other options and ways that they can cope with the stresses of life that those stresses, quite frankly, aren't going to go away, as we know.
True.
As adults.
Yeah, true. They're not going to go away, but it's when you get positive feedback for some things and it feels good, hey, you want to do that more often. I wonder, you know, it is obviously a national problem. I don't know how long, it doesn't seem like it's been going on all that many years. How are you guys funded and where is the funding nationally? Is it coming down appropriately? I mean, all politicians seem to talk about it and, you know, sometimes feed off the problem for their own electoral benefit. What's the federal government doing and state and perhaps even local government? So is that where your funding is largely
from? You know, as far as the federal funding, you know, I think obviously things get tied up pretty tightly and, it, you know, the trickle down isn't what we would hope for it to be. Mm-hmm. We tend to, in our organization, rely a lot on
private
donations.
Yeah.
So it's not quite, you know, the money's not really there.
Of course not. Of course not, where it's really most needed. Well, I wanted to mention now and at the end, we're going to go till about half an hour. The thing that's coming up October 19th in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where the show is coming from, who is the target audience for that and how can people sign up? Tell us about that event.
So the target audience for that event is a great question. I mean, I think it's people who are interested in supporting what we're doing and building that awareness. You know, when we do these events, it's not just building funds, that's a part of it, but it's also building awareness and really spreading the word. I mean, I can't tell you how many people still don't know who we are and what we're doing. And that's kind of scary because we're one of the only co-occurring IOPs for adolescents in the state. And so when we do these events, we want to help spread the word about where resources are and quite frankly, like you mentioned, where the money is going or where it's coming from. And there's a lot of people with a lot of great ideas. But, you know, for us, we're really looking at hitting these adolescents before it becomes a huge problem that's causing them to be inpatient for years on years.
It's just so... It's just so hard for me to believe, but I know that kids, you know, their brains are not fully developed. That's a fact. Physically, they're just not fully developed until like 25 or so. So even marijuana, which I think is, you know, pretty for an adult, you know, it's one thing, but for a kid, it's something else entirely. I wanted to ask about different approaches. It appears to me the law enforcement model has been a complete and utter failure, where there's a demand, there will, of course, be a supply. It's just a law of capitalism. Given the failure of law enforcement model, what are cities and towns doing that offers hope to cut demand? There's got to be models that can be replicated fairly easily, I would hope, in terms of cutting demand. Because, again, you know, just going after the suppliers, there's always going to be more suppliers where there's a profit to be made.
Right. That's a really tough question. You know, and I think... probably everyone has a different opinion on that. I do think that cutting the demand down really, it can often speak to, again, the availability of resources for support and help. Because if someone doesn't feel they have access to a support, and that might even, that could be anything from AA, HA meetings to a recovery center or a therapist, but if they don't feel like they have anywhere to turn but their dealer to feel better, then that's where they're going to keep turning. And so... I think that a lot of law enforcement, you know, one great example I think is, and it speaks to the stigma as well, but was sort of the effort, and I'm not really sure where we are with it right now, but that effort to buy fire stations in New Hampshire to, if anyone walked into a fire station and said they needed help, the firemen, you know, they're not charging these people, they're trying to help them. And I think that that's the direction that the community really needs to be going, because it speaks to, you know, we're putting our hands out to pull people up, instead of folding our hands or putting our hands in the air and saying, I don't know what to tell you. So, you know, if we're doing that, then these people, of course, they're dealing with a very strong chemical addiction in their brains. They're not just going to be able to stop without a huge amount of support. And and so similar to any disease, it's not something that people should be left alone to fight. I mean, and I think with the demand, you know, there's, you know, certainly movements, you know, when you're talking about legalizing marijuana and all of that, but really at the root of it is the feeling, and the feeling that people are having when they use, and what the feelings that they're trying to escape from. And if we can talk about that and hit it at its root, then we might be able to make some change if people feel like they have somewhere to turn. I mean, if you've ever known someone who has an addiction or is trying to get help, it's incredibly difficult to find help. And so... what are they going to do? You know, they're going to keep spinning their wheels to try to find help. Eventually, they're going to say, okay, I need to use because I can't get the help I need. So,
In terms of availability, the drugs are easily available, but the help isn't so available. Wow.
Right.
That's nuts. That's really awful. Oh, it's rather depressing, I must say. And I've looked a little bit into this issue. My sense is that as the pharmaceutical manufacturers not long ago had a marketing campaign based on what they called an epidemic of untreated pain, they must bear a high responsibility for hooking so many people on pain relief medicines. Have these, you know, well-dressed drug pushers stepped up to the plate? And if so, how? What is the pharmaceutical industry? I mean, they have a lot of responsibility for this stuff, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's speaking to the idea that no amount of pain is tolerable, and it's actually an aspect of what we kind of teach in our program and how we treat these adolescents is really looking at what is tolerable. You know, is it And for these kids, sometimes it's, well, you know, it's not, it's too distressing for me to be without my cell phone for a half an hour.
Right.
You know, that is
instant.
That's not tolerable for them. And so we're looking at, you know, now a lot of schools I know allow cell phones in the classroom. So it's looking at how can we address the concern that, you know, a little bit of pain is okay.
Yeah. You know, something about into each life, a little rain must fall. You know,
right.
You're right. And the instant thing, I mean, it amazes me, the kids with their cell phones, but that's another story. But it speaks to the instant gratification thing. And the pharmaceutical manufacturers, I mean, they are pushers to a large extent. They really have been. What would you like to see, you know, in your ideal world? Say if you were president or member of Congress, what would the federal government be doing here? What could be done with regard to perhaps the pharmaceutical suppliers as well as, you know, programs to cut demand?
Yeah, I mean, obviously regulations on a number of, you know, the amount of prescriptions that can be dispensed and, you know, even just dosage and refills. And I think that's starting to happen a lot more now. And then the education with that, because, you know, something that we're finding and maybe should be happening at the doctor's office and not, you know, when it's too late, is sort of saying, are these being locked up? Like just some education around it. You know, I go back to the fact that we have a lot of kids abusing cough medicine, and the amount of parents that I see that look at me like I'm crazy when I say, is your NyQuil locked up? You know, and who has access to it? It's a huge problem. And so really, really providing that education very heavily around, you know, when, if these prescriptions are going to be dispensed, what that means and who is in possession of them. But, and then I think just funding and looking at access to resources. And for me, if it were up to me, you know, well, if it were up to me, everyone would have access and it would all be free. But, you know, there's so much red tape when people are getting told no, and they have insurance, but their insurance doesn't cover it.
Eesh.
And it's a really flawed system.
Wow.
And people are being denied treatment. And to me, that's absurd.
Wow, that's interesting that the insurance doesn't cover it, because that puts the blame right back on the individual who that whole scenario is a big part of the problem. What about parents? I can't help but think that a lot of parents think, oh, not my kid. Are parents?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, and I think that, you know, again, that's one thing that we try to do here, you know, not just in the IOP at Seacoast Youth Services, but also in several of our other programs. And we do run a parent group every week, but is really helping connect the parents to other people's experiences and recognizing and identifying that there's not so much separating their kids from from kids that are struggling with addiction. And sometimes, to be honest, it's really just a matter of luck, who got caught and who didn't. And sometimes it takes kids getting unlucky, quote unquote, and getting caught doing things before it's realized that they have a problem. And again, it's why I say, you know, we're not really living in a time anymore where someone can say, oh, he's just smoking pot. He doesn't really have a problem, because, you know, as I mentioned, if your kid's at a party and they're smoking pot, or they're having even just a beer or two, there's other things going on at that party now, and that's something we're certain of, and there's without question, there will be people at that party with pills, and if you're 100% sure beyond the shadow of a doubt that your kid won't take one, well, then you're very lucky, because I don't know very many people that could say that, because the pressures that these kids are
under
to keep up and, you know, to
be cool,
feel accepted are huge pressures, and sometimes, you know, they'll say yes, even though you think that they won't.
Yep, that is for sure. Teenagers are impossible to understand, that's for sure.
Right.
So again, this October 19th event, tell us more about who's going to be there and who might be interested in showing up and how they sign up.
Oh, so the October 19th event, who will be there?
We're talking about opioid addiction and kids and what can be done about that.
I know I'm speaking, but sometimes they just show up and
just do your thing.
So, we'll be discussing the complexity of adolescent substance use disorders and our programs, of course. I know Brianna McLaughlin and will be there. She works with adolescents combating substance use disorders and homelessness. So the event is open and free to the public, but advanced sign-up is required. Okay, so
yes.
Space is limited. So to sign up, you would email Janet Stevens at Comcast.net. So that's Janet Stevens at Comcast.net.
Yes.
And then guests are asked to donate a gift card to a retail store, a grocery store, a gas card, anything, really. The event is sponsored by Kitty Sununu and Janet Stevens, and it's being held.
Strawberry Bank.
It sounds like it will be a really great event. It'll be at Strawberry Bank Museum, which is beautiful.
Oh, yes.
And from 6 to 8:30, anyone who's been to Strawberry Bank knows it. I mean, it's worth a trip just to hang out in Strawberry Bank for the afternoon. So it's open to the public. And really, with any of these events, like I said, where it's not just all about the fundraising, it's about spreading awareness.
Yes.
And not just about our program, which, I mean, obviously that's, you know, a motivation for us. We're always hoping for people to know. We want people to know what they have access to, and we don't deny services really to anyone. If someone doesn't have insurance or their insurance doesn't cover the program, which most will, to be honest, because insurance are starting to kind of realize that they've got to step it up and they want to avoid having to pay for something larger.
Probably. Exactly,
but,
yes.
We'll make it work. Our motto here is whatever it takes. So if there's a kid that needs services, we will make sure that they get them. So that's a big piece of what we're hoping to do at this event in Strawberry Bank next week, is really spread that awareness. Make sure people know where help is if they need help.
Well, we got to do something about this. Sweeping it under the rug has not worked particularly well at all, and the whole law enforcement thing is just hasn't worked either. Well, Sarah Fitras, Director of Intensive Outpatient Program Services at Seacoast Youth Services, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you especially for your crucial work in this area.
Thank you so much.
All right, and we'll be back in just a few minutes talking about the latest in Catalonia, Spain. October 1st, there was a brutal crackdown against democracy in the Catalan region of what is now Spain. Over 800 people were injured by police. Could there actually be a new civil war? Spain endured a brutal civil war in the late 1930s when fascist Generalissimo Franco came to power, and the people of Spain suffered terribly until his death in 1975. Spain took a turn toward democracy in 1978, and though unemployment remains terribly high, until very recently, Spain has remained a relatively stable, though regional alliances consistently continued to bubble just under the surface. The Basque separatists laid down their arms recently, but now Catalonia, the northeast region of what is now Spain, is demanding independence. In a highly questionable maneuver by the Madrid government of Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy, the National Police came down hard on the right to vote itself. The referendum was held October 1st despite heavy-handed police violence, openly trying to disallow democracy. Of course, this maneuver backfired and only greatly increased the sentiment for Catalonian independence. Of those who risked so much and were able to cast their votes, some 90% of the ballots cast favored independence. Prime Minister Rajoy has threatened to use all legal means to stop the apparently overwhelming will of the people. And in a real surprise, the King of Spain, Felipe VI, went on TV to condemn the vote and the demand for democracy itself. That triggered a massive general strike in Catalonia. Now, to put it mildly, Spain and Catalonia are at a major historic crossroads. Will democracy be crushed? Will this new nationalism reawaken old demons? Is there a threat of anything like a return to the militaristic authoritarianism of Franco's fascist government? How likely is a war for independence? How possible is meaningful dialogue between Madrid and Barcelona? I'm very pleased to have with us today my friend Sebastian Faber, professor of Hispanic Studies at Oberlin College. Thanks for being with us, Sebastian.
My pleasure, Bert.
He is a professor of Hispanic Studies at Oberlin College, former chair of the Board of Governors of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives. And if you don't know, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade was Americans who fought for democracy against fascism in that old Spanish Civil War. Faber is the author of Exile and Cultural Hegemony, Spanish Intellectuals in Mexico, 1939 to 1975. He's co-editor of ALBA's quarterly magazine, The Volunteer, and regularly contributes to Spanish and U.S. media, including The Nation. He's author of the new book, Memory Battles and the Spanish Civil War. I want to read that. Well, again, thanks for being with us. The New York Times recently noted that, quote, the tension surrounding Catalan autonomy was one factor that pushed Spain into a civil war in the 1930s, end of quote. We will know very soon if Catalan President Carles Puigdemont will unilaterally declare the independence of a Catalan republic. Given the iron-fisted police crackdown, I hate to even ask this, how likely is a new Spanish civil war, Sebastian?
I think it's not very likely an actual civil war. I think what is likely, though, that when the Catalan parliament will come together for the first time since the referendum that was held on October 1st, it is expected that Carles Puigdemont will, in some form, declare independence. And then what is likely is a further attempt by the government of Madrid to prevent that from happening. And the likely tool then will be, again, legal and judicial. There's a couple of options on the table. Madrid may invoke Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution, which allows the central government to revoke the autonomy of an autonomous region, and Catalonia is an autonomous region, if that region fails to fulfill its obligations to the state. Another option that some people are discussing is a state of exception. There is also an article in the Spanish Constitution, Article 8, that charges the army with protecting the integrity of the Spanish nation, Spanish national territory, and of course, secession is one way to threaten that integrity. So, regardless of what happens in reaction to this likely declaration of independence, it will only further escalate the situation, and will not provide a solution that can be called political. It might be true that the reaction of the Spanish state follows the letter of the law, in this case, the Constitution. And it might be true that some of the actions will not be formally coming from the government, but from the judicial branch. Yet, I think the real political problem on the table that will have to be solved sooner or later will be how to organize Spain in such a way that all of its constituent nationalities, all of its constituent national identity feel at home in it.
Yeah, I wonder if that can happen now. I mean, the crackdown was pretty rough. And I know that, you know, in this country, in America, there's the three branches of government, one of which is the judicial. Am I correct that the constitutional court, a lot of the judiciary system, is a bit of a relic from Franco times?
There's some way in which judicial personnel, so judges, magistrates, justices, are to some extent, depending on their age and their training, have some links to the former regime, because there was never in Spain's transition to democracy, there was not a purge at the level of the judiciary, or for that matter, the level of the government either. So that's true. But I think what's more important to consider is that the Spanish judicial system is heavily politicized. That is to say that the appointments of the members of, for example, the Constitutional Court happens as a function of the power relations between political parties. So as a result, when the Spanish Constitutional Court in 2010 rejected as unconstitutional a new statute of autonomy for the Catalan region, and that statute had been already passed and approved by the Catalan Parliament, the Spanish Parliament, and a referendum in 2006, so 4 years earlier. When the Constitutional Court rejected that new statute of autonomy, that was widely read as a political act rather than a mere judicial act.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that it was because everybody knew that the composition of the Constitutional Court was the result of politicized nominations, politicized appointments, rather. So in that way, currently also, the way in which the Rajoy government mm-hmm. is mobilizing or relying on the judiciary also has some people wondering whether, to what extent the separation of powers is not being severely undermined currently in Spain.
By the judiciary or by Rajoy or who would
by be? By the politicization of the judiciary and by the wow. collusion of the powers that be within the judicial branch and the people that hold power in the executive branch.
Are people paying attention to that in Spain? I would think they would be. It seems to me that people in the U.S. are particularly unsophisticated politically as compared to places in the rest of the world. Is there concern about that relationship between the judiciary and the executive?
Yes, no, absolutely, there is. There is, definitely. And, I mean, one of the things to keep in mind is that this crisis around Catalonia is yeah. unfolding in a larger conjuncture that really starts with the Great Recession in 2009, which hit Spain in 2009, and then the Indignados movement in 2011 and the founding of Podemos in 2014, all of which are chapters in an awareness, in the birth of awareness among the Spanish people and civil society that the way things are currently organized in Spain should be changed. So there has been over the past number of years a wide and broad and increasing dissatisfaction with the way in which the political class operates, in the way in which the political class colludes with the economic powers that be, and in the way in which both collude with the judicial branch. So that discontent is currently manifesting itself in Catalonia in a very specific way, namely in a desire first for self-determination mm-hmm. and second potentially for independence. But it's part and parcel, at least in part, of this same general discontent with what is now referred to often in shorthand as the regime of 1978. So this is the political system and the collection of elites that were put into place when Spain transitioned to democracy after Franco. Franco died in 1975, and the current constitution dates of 1978. And this general discontent is currently manifesting itself in Catalonia by this sort of broad popular sense that as people from Catalonia, we are not respected in Spain, we don't belong in Spain, we don't want to belong to this Spain. And the way in which the Madrid government has reacted to these aspirations over the past number of years, but especially in the last month, only confirms the sense among the people in Catalonia who feel this way, that they are right to feel this way, that there's nothing, really literally nothing at all, that Madrid, as it currently stands, and the Spanish state, as it's currently configured, can offer them that is better than the very risky yes. adventure of independence. And it is very risky. It's not a gratuitous adventure by any means, mm-hmm. because should independence actually occur or should Catalonia move in that direction, there's all kinds of questions that are completely unanswered,
yeah.
whose provisional answer looks pretty bad for Catalonia. For example, will Catalonia be able to continue as a member of the European Union?
Right.
Well, the provisional answer to that from Brussels is, Not no way. Catalonia will have to leave the European Union,
Ooh.
Potentially also the Eurozone, and will have to reapply. Well, that is a big change for many yeah. people in Catalonia. Another question on the table is, will Catalonia have to form its own army? What will the borders with Spain look like? Will there be import and export tariffs for Catalonia and Spain? Currently, Spain constitutes about half of what would be the export market for Catalonian industry and commerce. if that there's any kind of anything else but free trade in that relationship that could negatively affect the Catalan economy. A big question on the table is, will FC Barcelona be able to continue to play in the Spanish soccer league or not? Mm. It seems silly, but those questions are important to people, yeah. And they are as yet unanswered. So it's interesting that despite all this insecurity surrounding the question of independence, there is still a significant portion of Catalan society, polls indicate between 40% and 50%, that are so convinced that continuing in Spain as it stands currently is so bad, so negative, that they'll take whatever the alternative might be as independence. I think that will be better than what we currently have.
Oh, my goodness. That is kind of, that's unsettling for sure. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Sebastian Faber, professor of Hispanic Studies at Oberlin College, and we're talking about the current state of Spain and Catalonia. And I wonder if I'm hearing you right. I'm like extrapolating a little bit here. In 1978, they formed, they headed toward democracy. Has there been a frustration since then that is affecting what's going on in Catalonia, and that it hasn't been really full self-determination, full democracy yet? Is that a factor in all this?
Yes, I think the different phases of discontent that I just described, starting in with the Great Recession and then the Indignados movement and Podemos, generally that discontent has been framed as a lack of democracy, a lack of democratic caliber in Spanish society. And that is generally, by the critics of current democracy in Spain, is traced back to the way in which the transition to democracy came about in the late 1970s. The transition came about through a negotiated pact between the Franco regime, which had lost its leader, and the anti-Franco opposition. And it's currently, by the critics, it's currently believed that that compromise has now outlived its usefulness.
Uh-huh.
And that Spain has evolved as a civil society, has evolved so much that it needs more democracy. Generally speaking, it's considered that the structures put in place in 1978 are fairly paternalistic and do not leave much room for civil society involvement in politics at all. And so the demand is for more democracy.
Imagine.
Now, what that looks like... Yeah. Is actually a second question. Currently, within the national question of Catalonia, it is framed, for example, as the right to self-determination.
Right.
So the idea being, going back to the Wilsonian idea of the self-determination of peoples, that if the people in Catalonia are in fact a people, that is a nation,
right,
then they should be able to invoke the right to self-determination. They should by themselves be able to vote whether they want to remain within the Spanish state or be independent. The problem is that the Spanish Constitution 1978, which is the law of the land, very explicitly says that the unity of Spain is indivisible and that the sovereignty resides in the Spanish people. It doesn't acknowledge other peoples within the whole of the Spanish people. So legally speaking, there is no Catalan people that can invoke the right to self-determination.
I read that at least 350,000 people filled the streets of Barcelona stating their opposition to independence, their opposition to secession. That was a surprise to me. What do you know about that? Please tell us.
It was impressive as almost as the other manifestations have been. So I think there's a couple of things to keep in mind here. One is that it is true that Catalan society is strongly divided, almost 50-50, between people that favor independence and people that do not favor independence. So it's not surprising that those opposed to independence would take to the streets days before independence might be declared. At the same time, it's important to keep in mind that on both sides, the fight for or against independence or for or against the unity of Spain is one way to fight other political battles. So that the demonstration in Barcelona became also a way to celebrate Europe, but also a way to reaffirm a very conservative, almost reactionary vision of Spain as a single homogenous culture. On the other side, among those who fight for self-determination of the Catalan people or even for independence, there too are politically there are different things going on. it's important to keep in mind that the what you could call the independence movement currently in Catalonia consists of a strong core of civil society mobilization, almost independent of political parties, at least initially independent of political parties, that by now has been, you could say, co-opted or mobilized by political parties for fairly party political interests.
Mm-hmm.
A good example is the, as we've mentioned, Rajoy. Rajoy is the head of the Partido Popular, the Popular Party, which is the leading center-right party in the Spanish state. Its counterpart in Catalonia is a party that used to be called Convergence, Convergencia, that has now changed its name to Democratic Party of Catalonia, but it's the same, it's a center-right party. So this is the party responsible for the cutbacks in the wake of the Great Recession. This is a party that's fairly corrupt, that tends to privilege big business, that is has overseen a fair amount of privatizations of public services, your typical sort of like European center-right party. That party is one of the key proponents for self-determination and independence currently.
Interesting.
It did not used to be. It made a kind of an about phase in 2012 after the kind of grassroots rise of independence aspirations. This conservative party decided that it made sense politically to champion that cause as well. So among the pro-independence coalition is basically the ideologically closest partner in Catalonia of the ruling Partido Popular in Madrid, which is cracking down on the independence movement. So there's an interesting way in which the independence cause cuts right through political alliances and divisions. On the other hand, on the opposite side of the political spectrum in Catalonia is a party called CUP, the CUP, which is an assembly-based, bottom-up, horizontalist, radical left party for whom independence is the ticket out of what they see as a socially unjust, capitalist, reactionary Spanish state. They've allied themselves with their political enemies in Catalonia, the Conservative Party, in a very pragmatic way, they believe, and they are strongly convinced that once they reach independence, they will be able to break their alliance with the Conservatives and start fighting the Conservatives tooth and nail like they have been doing all these years over social policies, tax policies, income distribution, all those things within an independent Catalan Republic. So it's important to realize that the independence movement in Catalonia, even though it coincides in its claim to self-determination and in its driving toward independence, has politically extremely divergent agendas once that independence might have been reached.
But it sounds like perhaps it's bringing people together in a really new way, kind of surprising way, and is perhaps unintentionally moving toward kind of a leftist leaning, you know, away from control by, you know, the universal thing, you know, the big rich powers, and maybe restoring more real democracy. So how does this affect the young leftist Podemos party? Where do they stand on the, might they be in a unique position to bring justice and to control the chaos here?
That's a really good question. Currently not. The way it has played out, or the way that the leaders of Podemos have played it out, or have tried to position themselves in this very complicated situation, has not benefited Podemos. In fact, it has divided Podemos. There are currently divisions between the Madrid leadership and the Catalan leadership of Podemos, and Podemos's closest allies in Catalonia, which is the party founded by the current Barcelona mayor, Ada Colau, this very charismatic woman politician coming out of the anti-foreclosure movement. She sort of surprisingly won the elections in 2015 and became the mayor of Barcelona, where she's implementing very progressive and forward-looking policies, at least trying to. So her position on the independence and self-determination movement has been undecided in a way. She has said she is in favor very much of a referendum. She believes Catalonia has the right to determine its own fate, but she has not said that she's in favor of independence. Now, her relationship to Podemos is friendly, but she's not of Podemos, and she's very clearly and clear in her declarations that she says, "I don't belong to Podemos." She has created a new political space, kind of a new kind of party called the Commons, Els Comuns in Catalan, and Podemos was invited to join that, but Podemos Catalunya decided, its leadership decided against joining that space, whereas some of its rank and file did decide to join that space. So there's just to illustrate to what extent the national question has managed to divide Podemos as a party, as a movement. On top of that, what happens in situations like these, very polarizing situations like these, driven by a question such as national identity, which is deeply emotional,
sure,
and for many people, and not quite rational, mm, and in the context where we saw in the referendum, people put their physical safety on the line in order to vote, they expose themselves to police abuse in order to vote. The pragmatic, not quite pragmatic, the sort of middle of the road position that Podemos is trying to adopt, saying like, we believe in self-determination, but we don't think Catalonia should leave, and we believe in constitutional reform. This is kind of a rational, pragmatic, mm-hmm, compromise that they're looking for. They say we want dialogue, we want Catalonia to stay. That doesn't sell well in a situation where people are at each other's throats. So there's a way in which the polarization makes Podemos look like it's trying to play both sides, or it's non-committal, right? When Podemos is trying to say, no, but this question about independence is really a distraction that is fracturing the left, that's true, but they themselves are part of the left that's being fractured by it, and they're paying the price for that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it is complicated. I don't know if I can do two more questions. I wanted to ask about, what's with the king, King Felipe VI, coming out? That's very unusual. What's the effect of him making preemptive excuses for a further military crackdown? What's the effect of the king speaking out on this?
Yeah, so he came on television unusually. That doesn't happen very often. There have been a couple of moments in recent Spanish history where the king appearing on television had an important function. Most importantly, there was a failed military coup in February 1981. 3 years after the new constitution was adopted, where a military tried to take over the government, and the king then appeared on television in the middle of the night and basically did not give his support to the military coup and did give his support to democracy, and that was generally seen as a key watershed moment. Last week's appearance by the king was quite different in its effect. The king really tried to do two things, I think. He tried to reconfirm the constitutional order, stating that the attempts by Catalan politicians to force a self-determination referendum and to move toward independence went directly against the Spanish constitution, and that they had placed themselves outside of the legal order. And he was, strictly speaking, right in that. He also clearly, it seemed to me, tried to affirm the authority of the Spanish state in the same way that the police crackdown had affirmed the authority of the Spanish state as the only entity to legitimately use violence, right? Mm-hmm. To go back to Weber's definition. By doing that second part, by reaffirming the authority, I think rhetorically he missed a great chance to at least make a gesture toward those people who had been beaten by the police, or those people who are genuinely not happy in Spain. He missed the opportunity to make any gesture of sympathy or understanding or tolerance toward them. Mm. By not mentioning the police crackdown, by not saying anything about the people who had suffered from the police crackdown, he really managed to further alienate those people in Catalonia who do not see him as their legitimate king, mm, and who don't see the Spanish state as a positive future for them.
Good work, Philippe. One last question. How might this tense situation be diffused? Is it too late for dialogue? Does the Spanish constitution have to be reformed? What do you see as the future on this?
I mean, the long-term solution can only be constitutional reform, because there's only so long that a state can hold it together when such a large part of it doesn't feel it belongs, it fits. And the Spanish state is powerful, like all states, and it does certainly have legal and security means at its disposal to outlaw political parties, to deploy violence in different ways, mm-hmm, to keep the discontent down, but in the long run, that's not sustainable in the current European Union, I would hope. So the end game must be ultimately that's the constitutional reform. How that comes about and what that will look like will depend on the short term. And it's, to me, I don't see positive things happening before more negative things will happen. Mm. I think negotiation will have to happen, but the current political leadership in Catalonia and in Madrid, I don't think is capable of doing that in terms of ideology, in terms of psychological makeup, in terms of political instinct, and in terms of political capital, I think that's been spent. So one option is for the European Union to either indirectly or directly intervene. Another option might be for some people with still more political capital to move in and force negotiation. Currently, what we have seen is that the escalation has increased, not just at the level of confrontations among politicians or between politicians, the judicial branch, but also, more worryingly, among the population, whereby, so a part of these, the popular mobilization for or against Catalan independence and for or against the unity of Spain, we've seen some very ugly, worrisome manifestations of extreme right-wing Spanish nationalism with rituals and slogans and symbols straight from the Franco period. So there's a way in which the crisis is, among other things, showing that Spain does have an extreme right-wing political movement, and so far it has sort of was hiding out within the center-right party, but it's certainly there. And it also is manifesting itself in ways that we are used to now seeing in Germany and Holland and France and Greece, and we hadn't quite in Spain, but that is now also something that has appeared into the, in the eyes of the cameras, let's say.
That's not very hopeful, but well, it is what it is. Thank you so much. I know you have limited time, Professor Faber, Sebastian Faber.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thank you so much. You have a new book coming out called Memory Battles and the Spanish Civil War. I look forward to reading that. When will that one be on the stands?
I think it's officially coming out in January. It's about photography, fiction, and history, and it's really about the way that Spain is currently dealing with the legacy of the Civil War and Francoism.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. Hopefully they can have more democracy in Spain. I'm all for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bert.